At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Suddenly a single cry arose from inside the crowd. Kill the black one first. There was a roar, guttural, like laughter, like fury, the fury of the mob. Kill the black one first is a story about race, identity, belonging and displacement. Kill the black one first is a memoir from Michael Fuller, Britain's first ever black chief constable, whose life and career is not only a stark representation of race relations in the UK, but also a unique morality tale of how humanity deals with life's injustices. Joining me live on the line from the UK is Michael Fuller. Michael, good morning to you.
Good morning to you.
Good to have you with us this morning. In terms of, and I review an awful lot of books, an awful lot of memoirs, in terms of titles, that this one stands out, Kill the Black One First. Quite horrifying. What just set me the context where that actually comes from.
Well, Kill the Black One First is what was shouted at me, and I was the only black cop amongst some 30 white police officers, and that one of the rioters shouted that at me, and it was the first experience I'd had of a petrol bomb being thrown at me. I mean, riots were very unusual in Britain. The police weren't trained to deal with riots. And I'd never been in such a hostile situation and such a frightening situation as on that day in Brixton in 1981.
Let's start with how you became a police. I want to come back to those riots and the effect it had on policing and indeed the national psyche, because I think anybody in the 80s remembers it very, very well indeed. Your story is a unique one. When did you first become, realise that you wanted to become a policeman?
Well, I grew up in care, so I was brought up in a children's home in Surrey, and that's because my parents, who were the Windrush generation, split up quite soon in the late 50s after they'd arrived in England. And I, at the age of 18 months, right through to 16 years and 16 and a half years old, I was in care and brought up by an amazing woman who was called Auntie Margaret, who sadly she died when I was 16 and a half, and just after I told her that I'd got into the police cadets, and she was absolutely thrilled and knew that that was something I was passionate about doing. I was passionate about joining the police. I was passionate about sleuthing as a child, solving crimes. So getting into the police was absolutely wonderful for me.
And what was the reaction like? Because not an awful lot of sort of young Afro-Caribbean males wanted to go into the police force. It was seen as unusual. And this would be, and excuse me, I've got my dates wrong, would this be early 70s?
Probably mid-70s, about 77.
Right.
I actually joined the police, 1975, I joined the police cadets. But I wanted to join at the earliest opportunity. But all my friends, anyone of influence, both my mother and father, who I didn't live with because I was in care, but my teachers, my school friends, everybody said, don't do it, other than Auntie Margaret, who sadly had died. But she was the only person who supported my decision to do it. And that, it was a very difficult time. The context was, it was the Alf Garnett era where people were openly racist and would use very racially offensive language. And when I first went out on the streets, the first day, of course, I didn't think it was a big deal being a black man in police uniform, but everybody else did. And literally, I walked in North End Road in Fulham in southwest London and literally stopped the traffic. It caused such consternation with people coming up and shaking my hands, but also groups of black youths actually shouting, "Traitor, traitor," and being very aggressive towards me. So it was quite a strange experience. And I thought, well, after the first day, I can't do this every day. This is just impossible. And as time went on, people got more used to seeing me and were very friendly. I got to know a lot of the people and, thoroughly enjoyed the policing.
I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that you had groups of Afro-Caribbean men saying traitor. Did you feel when you were in, because I'm looking at now at the pictures of you at the training at Hendon, the graduation picture, you are the only black face in there, and also for your, when you win the cross country, the orienteering championships as well. When you were actually a cadet and those first days on the force, we tend to think of the police force in the 70s as, the Sweeney, I suppose we take it from the media, or Life on Mars. It's a different animal to the police force that we have today, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, there's always been a sort of dark sort of humour in terms of what police officers as a group would find funny. But, I mean, the problem I had is the racism within the police. I mean, whilst the majority of officers weren't racist and, of course, supported me because you relied on other officers for your safety, there were a number of officers that I encountered, and some of them were a lot more senior than me, who were unashamedly racist and would make racist statements. We were told one day to go out and get some arrests and make sure at least one of them is black. And I can remember looking gobsmacked and shocked at the senior officer saying this. And there was no way that he was going to let me challenge anything that he said. So I found that very difficult. And there were some people, a lot of racist banter, which I used to find very wearing. And then, of course, I'd go out on the streets and get flack from members of the black community, or certain members of the black community. And the whole thing was very, very wearing. And it was very much about the context at the time.
How did you keep your head together, as we say these days, in that? Because obviously if you're getting, and I don't suppose if you're getting a racist abuse from all sides, I mean, you can't go to your superior officer and say, "I'm having a problem with racism," because it's your superior officer who is joining in as well.
Well, at the end of the day, that I was always very willing as a police officer. I'd take on anything that I was asked to do. I'd volunteer to do things. So, for example, one of the things police officers hated doing is dealing with domestic disputes, delivering death messages, so telling people that their relatives had died, searching dead bodies that had been pulled out of the Thames. I mean, I would take on any task and help other police officers. And not surprisingly, I became an accepted and a popular member of the team. I loved catching criminals, which, rubbed off on the other police officers. They wanted to come out walking with me. And you were highly dependent on the other officers for your safety. So if you didn't get on with them, if you weren't accepted, if you weren't part of the group, then you would be at serious risk of being injured. And, it's the acceptance that I needed, acceptance from the team, acceptance from the organisation that I was looking for.
Also, the best way to silence critics, I suppose, is to excel. And you did that when you, along with PC Mark Jordan, won the Police Cadet Scholarship to attend Sussex University.
Yes, I think the record on children from care going to university is very poor. And I hadn't even considered going to university, but I did A-levels in the cadets because, it's a great opportunity to continue studying, even though I'd started at 16 and a half. I got my A-levels, and the director of academic studies says, well, what about university? And I said, well, I want to carry on with my police career. And he said, well, you can do that as well. So I went to university, and that was quite a weird experience, being at university, particularly at Sussex, because I wanted to study psychology. But it was at a time when universities were very radical, and that I described the experience in the book of being there as a cop, and the things that happened whilst I was there.
Let's go forward then to 1981 and Brixton. And I mentioned a little bit earlier in the interview that it was a seminal point in policing and in social history in the UK, especially in London. Give me a bit of build-up, if you would, about what the situation was in Brixton just prior to the riots. What was the spark? And you know, because this is where policing in London and riot policing has a good look at itself.
Well, there was a build-up to the riots in 1981. I mean, it's well sort of set out in the Scarman, Lord Scarman, who was a judge who wrote a report about it. The problem in Brixton before the riot was that there were high levels of robbery and crime. And as a result, the police, because there were a lot more resources in those days, swamped the streets of police officers, and they would stop and search anyone, the predominantly black youths. And the repeated stopping and searching of black youths, people being arrested for being a suspected person. So at the time, there was an offence that if you were suspected of hanging around with a view to committing a crime, you could actually be arrested for it as a suspected person loitering around, effectively, to commit a crime. So lots of black youths were arrested for sus, as it was caused. And that, the combination of stop and search, arrest for sus, and the swamping of the area to reduce the crime, created huge resentment from the local black youths in Brixton, and huge anger. And of course, I describe the scene in the prologue of the book where I get off the bus, and really, I'm really the target for all that anger and all that history that's gone on before I've got to Brixton. And there was huge anger, and that, you know, ultimately there were the riots. And I remember at the end, when we were being bussed away as police officers from Brixton, I thought, well, there were black youths shouting at us, you know, we won, go away. And I thought, well, no, nobody's won this at all. If you look at the area, the cars trashed, the buildings and shops burnt out. And, you know, some of the police officers left after that because they didn't like the way some of the senior officers had commanded the riots, because, as I said, we weren't used to dealing with riots. And everybody, including the local residents, but also the police officers, were very demoralised, and nobody benefited from that at all.
And if you look at the images from that time, if you go onto your social media, your Google, and you look at the images, what strikes you is the fact that when we have crowd control situations now, police are equipped with, you know, full face helmets, riot shields, batons, the body armor, the whole thing. And if you look at these pictures, and I know it's 1981, but basically the police officers who are trying to control or who are facing the rioters are basically wearing what they would do to do a beat around Parsons Green.
Yes, I mean, we had ordinary clothing. We were called away from normal beat duty, and that, yeah, I mean, the experience, I mean, I can remember the literally a sounded like broken glass right in front of me, and I thought somebody has thrown a bottle. I smelt petrol fumes, and I thought, what the hell's that? And the next thing is there were flames shooting up, and I had a shield, so I thought I was safe. But I wasn't holding it properly, and nor was the guy beside me. And the flames shot up in front of both of us. He got his beard singed and was actually burnt, but not badly. And that we didn't know what we were doing. We weren't trained. And there was no way these shields, if they weren't used properly, were going to protect us. And I can remember thinking, well, actually, you know, I've spent yesterday, I was dealing with people who were poor and marginalized, who were suffering from drug abuse or alcohol abuse, people threatening to jump off buildings, and here I am, you know, at the receiving end of all the angst of this local community. And I thought, well, why? And why would I want to continue doing this job?
You talked a little bit earlier about, you know, the police, you rely on your colleagues, they've got your back. This must have been an absolute flashpoint for you, an absolute clarity, because presumably your colleagues stood with you shoulder to shoulder whilst you had Afro-Caribbean male shouting, "Kill the black one first."
Yes, and that was the thing. I mean, if it hadn't have been for the support of other colleagues, then I really couldn't have continued. So I knew that I craved acceptance from the other colleagues, because I was so dependent upon them for my safety. But the other thing I did, and I also describe, is I loved getting arrests. So I describe an incident with a burglar, and police officers rarely see somebody in the act of committing a crime. I think the criminologists say once every 5 years. But very, very early on in my career, I walked round the back of some shops and had a very violent confrontation with a burglar who was stealing 501 jeans. And, we had a violent struggle. He was arrested. But there was a very unhappy outcome at court. I mean, this guy had tried to stab me. And I was keen, and he was caught and captured, taken to court. And he got a conditional discharge for theft, which was very unfortunate, because the lead detective didn't appear at court to support the case. So, there were a lot of very big frustrations along the way, very early on in my career. But I absolutely loved it. You know, I absolutely loved policing. It was exciting. It was different. I had probably a shock every day seeing some of the poverty that I hadn't seen. And I think the thing it told me was that there was always somebody who was worse off than I am. So Auntie Margaret, who brought me up in care, and sometimes I couldn't go on school trips because the local authority couldn't afford to pay for me to go on school trips. So I would have to spend the week with a younger class at school. But Auntie Margaret still made me give a proportion of my pocket money to UNICEF and other children's charities, because she said, "Michael, you've got to realise there's always a child, there's always somebody who's worse off than you are."
You rose up through the ranks, and it's quite an astonishing rise. In the early 90s, sort of 12 years on from the Brixton riots, we find ourselves with another case that divides the public opinion and shakes the public credibility in the police, the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, or the Stephen Lawrence case. Where were you at that point, and what were your thoughts on what it did to the public confidence in the Metropolitan Police?
Well, at the stage of the Stephen Lawrence inquiry, I was middle ranking, and I'd actually passed a promotion board to be a chief superintendent. So there's lots of ranks, there's some 10 ranks in the police, and being a chief superintendent was very senior. But before I was promoted, they met who were in crisis with a criticism and the press criticisms over the what is often termed the botched investigation of the Stephen Lawrence murder investigation, and that I was asked to come up with some recommendations. What could the Met do to try and put things right? So I came up with a series of recommendations, and a lot of these were procedural things about murder investigations, so regular reviews of murder investigations that were unsolved, because often, you know, when you look at the murder investigation 3, 4, 5 years later, and we had a 5-year stipulated time period, that new evidence would come to light or forensic techniques had developed. So I'd recommended that to be routine, which was quite onerous. I'd also recommended family liaison officers. But more important, the racially motivated crime at the time wasn't really a concept that we knew of. So often the racial motivation was recorded on a crime report, but we didn't sort of categorize it and measure it. And that made it difficult for the police to tackle it. So what we did was we started recording where crimes were racially motivated. And because a crime against one, a racially motivated crime, not only has a damaging impact on the individual, it actually creates fear in the whole community. So we were able to map that crime, particularly throughout London, but all police forces later adopted this practice of mapping racially motivated crime. And then there was no excuse for the police not tackling that crime.
So there would be areas that that could be flashpoints for racially motivated crime if you mapped them out then?
Yes. Yes, and it was quite clear. I mean, there was anti-Semitic crime in certain places. There was racist crimes in certain parts of London. And that was stark. When you actually started mapping it, and that was new to us, we were... I think when I first started doing mapping, I borrowed a computer from the BBC because they were part of our crime prevention panel. And at the time, the Met only had computers for dealing with pay. But we developed, and it took a long time to develop the concept of crime mapping, but it made it very obvious as to where the problems were going to occur once you'd mapped out the actual crimes.
I suppose one of the things is the fact that you had to try and haul the police service from the early sort of 1920s into the 20th, late 20th, 21st century.
Yes, and yes, we were pushed into it, but I think the developments and what came out of it was groundbreaking at the time. And, we found it very, very exciting. And I think the officers will run around. I mean, nobody liked the label or the organisation that you work for being labelled institutionally racist. But the Met, as a lot of the police officers do, they got their heads down, they got on with the job, they went out, they made arrests. The Lawrence murder investigation continued to be investigated, and there were subsequent arrests and prosecutions, not of everybody involved, but there were some more arrests and prosecutions. And you know, police officers, as they always do, get their heads down and got on with it. But I mean, it was a very, very difficult, horrible time, and had a big impact on the morale of the staff at the time.
Talking about the campaigns that had a lot of impact, and it's something that is in the news every day. We're hearing more and more about knife crime, gun crime. You were one of the people, the forces behind Operation Trident. Just explain to the listeners what that was and its effect on gang warfare and gang culture.
Well, what I say, I mean, I can answer first. What I say to people about knife crime, particularly at the moment, is if there's the political will to tackle such a problem, then you will succeed. And we're talking about political will in preventing the problem occurring in the first place. Because my view is that you pay either way. If you don't prevent it, you pay for clearing up afterwards in terms of the police resources, the NHS resources. So what we did with Operation Trident, London was beset with gun crime, and that was very frightening. There was huge political will and huge resources put into reducing gun crime. I spent some 18 months before setting up an operation called Operation Trident, going to community groups saying, well, you've got to help the police tackle this problem. You've got to take ownership and responsibility as well. And to be honest, we had a joint commitment to reducing gun crime in London with huge support from the communities, particularly black communities. And when we started 18 months later, and we've had built our supercomputer to gather intelligence, we ended up inundated with 3,000 pieces of information, which if we hadn't built this supercomputer, we couldn't cope with. And the sort of information we had was so-and-so, and it would name so-and-so with a street name, is going to go and kill so-and-so. And we as police officers would then have to arrange an operation to make sure that didn't happen. But either way, we knew, and we were able to prevent a lot of the shootings and a lot of the crime by arresting people with guns and getting those guns destroyed and melted down and smelted down. And the government actually brought in a minimum sentence, a deterrent sentence, that if you were found in possession of a gun on the streets or in your home illegally, that you would face a minimum sentence of 5 years imprisonment. And I'm very confident that alone, as well as a lot of other things that we did, which were preventative, had a big impact on reducing, in fact, virtually stopping, certainly at the end of my 4.5 years on Operation Trident, the commissioner at the time said, well, the level of gun crime doesn't justify this unit. We had 160 police officers, and he said, well, it doesn't really justify that now. In terms of the level of gun crime has reduced so much. So either way, both the community and the police felt that our efforts had been very successful. And I said, well, these problems always return, so scale it down, but don't get rid of it completely. So that has been very successful. And, you know, we should learn from that experience in dealing with the issues of knife crime. If there's a concerted effort, political will, that you can get to grips with these problems. I think one of the problems is that the country's been deflected by other political considerations like Brexit. And the tackling of knife crime and the safety issues, the public safety issues, haven't been given enough prominence and importance. Well, as I said, we end up paying for it anyway. I mean, the victims of knife crime, there are over 1,000 victims last year, according to stats, 1,012, I think, to be precise. But either way, there's huge resources go into dealing with those victims, and police resources, but NHS resources, and the huge fear that's created as well within communities, which means that more young people then carry knives because they're fearful. So it very much is a cycle of fear and a cycle of violence, which if you don't stop it and prevent it, it only escalates.
What do you say to people who say, I mean, I've had conversations with ex-police officers who said that what we need to do then is bring in the same sort of laws that you had against gun laws, 5 years for carrying a knife, and all we should be able to bring back the controversial SOS laws. Would you think that that would be a way of treating it, or do you think we need to pump more money into the police force so that it's a proactive rather than a reactive force?
Well, some people say my view is old-fashioned, but I was actually grown up as a child with the and this was my Auntie Margaret, who would say, give me tremendous freedom, but if I didn't do what was said, or she would say, don't lie, cheat or steal, or you've got to be back at a certain time, she would say, if you're not back, there'll be consequences. And there's nothing like that for a child or a young person, knowing that if you do something wrong, if you break the law, there are consequences that you won't get away with it. And that's a principle I've used in successfully reducing crime, because I was moved around London, as you'll probably see from the book, as a detective chief inspector, because I was very successful at reducing crime. And that I use that message all the way through, i.e. that if you break the law, if you don't do what you told to do, that there will be consequences. But that you know, it worked with my children as well, who've grown up now and very successfully. But either way, that I don't think a lot of the young people involved in the knife crime and the violence associated with the knife crime, and particularly violence around drug markets, and we're talking very young children who act as couriers for older drug dealers, they don't realise there are consequences, and sometimes they don't know the difference between right and wrong. And certainly as a child, that was always made very clear to me, what was right and what was wrong. There were no grey areas, and I made sure that I stayed the right side of the line as a result. Despite the stigma that's often attached to children being in care, none of the children who grew up with those principles went off the rails or got involved in crime or got arrested at all. So, you know, my own view is that those principles, they're simple principles, but, you know, children knowing right from wrong, being set very clear boundaries, is what's needed with knife crime, and that you can't use violence to enact retribution on somebody who's upset you. And, you know, a lot of the young people involved in the knife violence don't seem to realise that, and a lot of them don't seem to realise they're doing wrong, and that's a big concern.
What do you hope that people will take away from your book, Kill the Black One First? It's an inspiring tale. It's a tale. You became Chief Constable of Kent, of course. It is really a proof that you can triumph against the odds.
Yes, I think that's the thing. I mean, I look back with immense sense of satisfaction, immense sense of affection for a lot of the people that I worked with. And, you know, I keep thinking, thank God I didn't listen to those people who were very influential in my life. Thank God I didn't listen to them. And I did join the police, because I had a brilliant career. And I was very, very sorry when I retired. To retire from the police. I thoroughly enjoyed my time, and I hope the book, by writing the book, because it was young people last year who said you've got to write a book, that I just hope it inspires everybody and anybody, particularly those who've had issues around belonging and feeling whether they belong or not, that I just hope it provides inspiration to people.
The book is called Kill the Black One First. It's out now on Bonnier Books. It's by Michael Fuller. Michael, if people want to find out more information, do you have your own website, or can they just go and...
Yes, there is a website. The publishers, Bonnier Books, have a website under the title Kill the Black One First, and it's there's a hashtag at Kill the Black One First as well for the book.
Michael Fuller, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.